I have never been much of a fisherman. I can recall the one time that I caught a fish was at a little trout farm outside of Boulder Creek, California. Lindsay, Chuck, and myself, we were all in the third grade, went for Chuck's birthday party up to this trout farm outside of Boulder Creek. Now, when you're at a trout farm, you look down and the fish, they're just numerous. They're just waiting to bite anything. You could just put a bare hook in there and they would latch on. So as Lindsay and Chuck put their lines in, man, they were pulling the trout out. Truly, it took me 15 minutes to catch a fish at that Boulder Creek trout farm. I have never been a good fisherman. I don't know if it's the fact that I lack patience or I have a certain odor. I'm not sure. But something causes fish to stay away from me. And over the years, that's caused frustration. Well, the one time I thought I really got it, I thought, man, I finally found a way to fish. I was skin diving outside of Monterey, a little place called Lover's Point in Pacific Grove. And the conditions were beautiful that day. Visibility was about 40 or 50 feet, and for that area, that's quite remarkable. We were down diving, and as I was diving, I had my Hawaiian sling with me. A Hawaiian sling is a long spear with a big rubber band attached to the end, and you stretch out the rubber band and let it go, and a spear shoots through your fish. My first time out, I went down and saw a large rock cod. And he was just hanging there, rather tamely. And he would just look at me and make no attempt to escape. And I thought, wow, amazing. So I got my Hawaiian sling slung. I stretched out that rubber band, went right close to that fish, and let it go. The spear went right through that rock cod's eye. And he was there at the end of my spear. And I surfaced up. And my family was on the beach there at Lover's Point, and I was waving this rock cod. I was just so elated, so excited. Wow, I got this rock cod. And I was waving it back and forth when I saw my brother motion me to get out. And I thought, what does that mean? I'm already out. I was out in the water at the time. And then I looked behind him, and sure enough, there was a police car. And the police car had its red and blue lights flashing. And the officer began to walk towards me with bullhorn in hand. Young man, would you come in immediately? So I swam in. I thought maybe he wanted my autograph or something. I don't know. I came in with my spear and the big rock cod dangling there. And as I came closer to him, I realized I was in trouble. You see, unknown to me, that area of Pacific Grove is an underwater game reserve. No wonder there were so many fish. And they were so tame. And that was the last time I went spearfishing. I decided, man, I'm retiring from fishing altogether. And I'm not much of a fisherman. It seems to kind of get me in trouble, get me frustrated or what have you. So I've sort of given it up, at least for the time being. There was one fisherman, though, who had the opposite experience. In this case, fishing didn't get him in trouble. This particular man was already in trouble, and fishing rescued him out of that difficulty. The man's name? Peter. That great, big, lovable fisherman. In fact, extra-biblical literature tells us that Peter was large in stature. He was really an incredible character, a man's man. And by occupation, by vocation, he was originally a fisherman. Here, we are going to see Peter being rescued from an uncomfortable situation when the Lord told him, go fishing. Let's read about it. Matthew chapter 17. Beginning at verse 24, and when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, doth not your master pay tribute? Here they are returning from Mount Hermon, where that glorious event, the transfiguration, had occurred. Now the disciples and Jesus are headed back to their headquarters at Capernaum. Capernaum is a lovely, lovely spot on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. It's a fishing village. It's tranquil, serene, incredibly beautiful. I don't blame Jesus at all for choosing Capernaum for his base of operations. A lovely spot indeed. And as they came to Capernaum, Jesus' headquarters, that fishing village there on the north shore of Galilee, the disciples were approached by some tax collectors. Now, these were not tax collectors raising money for the Roman Empire or for the political system. But these were those that were coming asking Peter, "Does your master pay tribute?" Speaking of the temple tax. You need to understand that in Jesus' day, the ministry of the temple was not supported by the tithes and the offerings of the people. They didn't pass baskets like we do. But rather, every man 20 years of age and above was required to yearly give a half shekel of silver. That tradition started clear back in the book of Exodus, chapter 30. There God declared that every male 20 years of age and older was to pay a half shekel of silver for his redemption. In fact, we are told in the law it was for atonement, lest plague come upon him. Interesting. They were to buy protection, buy salvation, buy redemption with silver. And then that silver was collected, we read in Exodus chapter 38. And that silver was used to form sockets by which poles that held up the tabernacle, that place of worship, were held solidly. This has caused no little controversy in theological circles. What does this mean? Is the law suggesting that a person can buy their salvation? That they can be on firm foundation, solid ground by paying money? You might say, I thought that salvation was a free gift. Yes, it is free. It's free for you, and it's free for me. But it was costly to Jesus Christ. You see, in the Bible, silver is the metal of redemption. And in so picturing, in so describing, God is showing us, illustrating to us, the fact that our solid salvation does not come cheaply, does not even come freely, in the sense that someone has to pay for us to be on solid ground and avoid the plague of damnation. But who paid it? Not you, not me. Peter would later write in his later writings, he would say, "For we were redeemed, not with corruptible things like silver and gold, but by the precious blood of the Lamb." We have been redeemed. We have been purchased salvation, not by our giving, but by His paying in our behalf with His own blood. That's the picture. That salvation has got to be paid for. Atonement is not cheap. I weary of people that say, you guys out at the Applegate, you Christians, you believe in a cheap grace. Gang, cheap grace is an oxymoron. An oxymoron means two words that don't belong together, like kind cruelty. It can't happen. Two words that don't fit together. Cheap grace is an oxymoron because grace is free, but it's not cheap. It costs Jesus everything. Jesus laid down his life that we might have atonement with the Father, protection from the plague of eternal fire. The issue is Jesus paid the price. It's not cheap. It cost him everything. Now for us, it's free, but it's not cheap. Jesus paid the price for you, for me. So when somebody indicts you or suggests to you about a cheap grace, tell them, you know, that's an oxymoron. That'll impress them. Those words just don't fit together. It cannot be, you see. Well, the silver was raised in the book of Exodus from every male and paid for the construction of the tabernacle in Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 32. We see the money was still being raised throughout the years, throughout the generations. That is a half shekel of silver, this time to maintain the temple that was being constructed. That practice, that custom went on until the time of Jesus. And now, tell me, does your master pay the temple tax to support the religious system, the temple and its operation? And Peter said in verse 25, yeah, or yes. And when he was come into the house, Jesus prevented him, or interrupted him. Mark that, would you? Peter's being interrupted earlier in the chapter when Peter was up on the mountain, when Peter had a bright idea. Ooh, this is great. Let's build three booths, one for Elijah, one for Moses, and one for Jesus. He was interrupted by a voice thundering from heaven, the voice of the Father. This is my beloved Son. Hear ye him. Peter, stifle. Your suggestion is invalid. It's off the wall. Listen to my Son. Peter was interrupted on the mountain by the Father. Now he's interrupted in the house by the Son. He's interrupted yet again. Before he even had a chance to say anything, Jesus is interrupting him, by the way. I hope you're interruptible. I hope whether you're on the mountain or in the house, the Father and the Son can interrupt you in your thoughts, in your activities, in your ideas, in your presuppositions, and that He can correct you and correct me when it's necessary. May God keep us interruptible, that we don't become dogmatic, that we don't become locked in to our thoughts, to our presuppositions. But that we say, Lord, interrupt me whenever I need adjusting, correcting. Well, the Lord interrupts Peter. Peter comes into the house, and the Lord Jesus prevented him or interrupted him, saying, what thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers? Simon, Peter, tell me. Who does a king tax? Does he tax the strangers or the citizens of the empire, of the realm? Or does he go through the castle knocking on his kids' doors saying, pay up, man, we got to keep this kingdom going? Does he charge his own family? Does a king tax his own children? Or does the king tax strangers? The answer is obvious. No king, no emperor is going to tax his own children. He taxes the strangers, the citizens, the nation. And so Peter, hearing this, said, the strangers, of course, verse 26. Jesus said, then the children are free. Get it, Peter? Who are you? You're a child of the king. Who am I? The King of Kings. Are we taxed by this temple tax when I am the king? Does that make sense logically? Peter, does it make sense? And Peter thinks, uh-oh. I get the point. When these guys said, does my master pay tribute? I said, sure. And now he's showing me how dumb that answer was. Poor Peter. He spoke a little too quickly yet once again. A lot like me. A lot like us. Then Jesus said, notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, these religious people, these temple tax collectors, go thou to the sea and cast a hook and take up the fish that first cometh up. And when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money or a stater, that is a full shekel of silver. That take and give it unto them for me and for thee. Peter, go fishing. And the first fish you pull out of the water, open its mouth and you'll find a stater. Enough money for me and for thee. Lest they be offended. I can see Peter now grabbing his hook and his line. That's what Jesus said to do. Now, that in and of itself would be most curious. Because professional fishermen like Peter was, and he had a reputation along with his brother in that community, they didn't use a line and a hook and a pole. They used nets and boats, big time stuff. This was rookie equipment. A line and a hook. And I can see Peter walking along the shore, carrying his little pole, tackle box, and all of his colleagues and contemporaries in the community looking at Peter, what's he doing? It would be like seeing Jose Canseco of the Oakland A's using a batting tee to try and hit the ball, you know? It doesn't work. It's just not that way. And yet, that's what the Lord told him to do. So he humbly and obediently takes his line and pole and bobber and worm, goes to the sea and casts it in, and sure enough, a fish is caught, and inside, a stater, enough to pay the tax for Peter and for his master. This miracle speaks to me in a number of ways. It's interesting to me on several accounts. First of all, it is the only miracle that Jesus ever did that deals with money. Isn't that interesting? Because when I watch the Christian channel on TV, that's all I hear about. Miracles of money, seed faith, keeping your vow, all that kind of stuff. Yet this is the only instance of the thousands of miracles that Jesus did that we have record of that ever dealt with money. Why is it that we as Americans concern ourselves in the area of the miraculous with money? Almost the majority of things deal with money. That's not the style of Jesus. Interesting. It is the only miracle not only dealing with money, but it is the only miracle where Jesus did something for himself. Every other miracle in the Bible, Jesus was concerned with others, not his own need. And yet, as I listen to these programs on TV and read their books on faith, it is always talking about, you can have your need met. Plant a seed in our ministry, and you will see what will happen to you. Fine. And that's the opposite of what Jesus said, what Jesus did. In fact, when Satan came to Jesus in Matthew 4 and said, why are you hungry? turn those stones into bread? Why are you, the Son of God, hungry? Is the Father not caring for you? Show your faith, take authority, and turn those stones into bread. Jesus turned to Satan and said, "Man shall not live by bread alone." Interesting. Totally the opposite of what we're seeing on TV today. What's being preached from pulpits across this country in the faith ministry. This is the only time that Jesus did a miracle for himself. And even so, it was not for himself. It was mainly to get Peter off the hook, if you would. Peter was out on a limb. Peter answered prematurely. Peter was in trouble, and Jesus said, "Oh, Peter, go fishing and you'll find some money. Pay it for you and for me, and let's not offend those guys." This was the only miracle that Jesus did that dealt with one fish. Other times Jesus did miracles with fish, it was always multitudes of fish, hauling them in or distributing them out. You know the story about the loaves and fishes where men were hungry. Jesus took a few loaves and a few fish and multiplied them miraculously. This only deals with one fish. You say, so what? Here's why that's important to me. There are people, commentators, galore, who read the story of the feeding of the 5,000. And here's what they say. Well, now, there really wasn't a miracle of the multiplying of fishes to feed 5,000. What happened? Jesus saw the crowd, saw they were hungry, and he asked who had some fish and some bread to share. Now, these commentators say that everybody in the crowd had fish and loaves tucked away in their garments. In those days, they wore puffy sleeves, and they would often carry their supplies, their food, their lunches in their sleeves, tied up. And commentators, some very famous, say what happened was when one little boy said, "I'll share my loaves, I'll share my fish," everybody said, "Oh." And they all took out their loaves, and they all took out their fish, and they all began to share, and there was no real miracle except for the miracle of sharing. And that's the message there. That's fishy to me. I don't buy that for a moment. The miracle of sharing. No, it was a miracle that the Lord did by his omnipotence, miraculously multiplying to feed a crowd. But for those who try and do away with the Lord's miracles by explaining them rationally or humanistically, deal with this one. How do you deal with a single fish caught with a hook? Notice the Lord said, "Take your hook," lest anybody say, "Well, there was a big net that Peter really used, and they scooped up old boots and a few coins and all kinds of stuff." No, it's a hook and a line and a single fish, and open its mouth, and there is a stater, a shekel of silver. You can't get around it. Unless you say the Bible is fallacious. There's no way to rationalize that one away. So I like this miracle because it's one that cannot be explained away humanly. I like this miracle because it shows Jesus' priority. Always in miracles, dealing with others, not centered on himself. Peter. This was not the first miracle that Peter ever saw happen. Did you know Peter saw a whole series of miracles that the Lord did just for Peter? Specifically for Peter? In Mark's gospel, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, Jesus goes into Peter's house and Peter's mother-in-law is sick with a fever. Her life is in danger. And Peter went and told Jesus, and Jesus came and touched her and picked her up. And it says, immediately the fever left her, and she ministered unto them. That is Jesus and Peter and the others. Maybe you've seen a lot of activity in ministry. People in the parking lot, or setting up tables, or staying late Sunday nights and counseling till the wee hours. And you wonder, why would people do that? Why would people teach Sunday school? Why would they stay late and pray? Why would they park cars at 7 o'clock in the morning when it's freezing cold? Why would they do such things? Are they crazy? No. But these brothers and these sisters work fervishly because the Lord has touched them and removed the fever of eternal damnation, saved their souls. What else can we do but serve Him, whatever that might mean for you in your life? We have no other choice but to serve Him, just like Peter's mother-in-law. Once she was touched by Him and raised up, immediately, Mark says, she began to minister to them. There's no other choice. When you've been touched by the Lord, you begin to offer service to the Lord because of what He's done for you. Then Peter saw another miracle shortly thereafter. Luke chapter 5 tells us about that. Jesus was being pressed by the crowds. As He was teaching on the seashore, the crowds gathered round about Him, and He needed some space that He might speak to them. So He said to Peter, "Could I borrow your boat?" "Sure, Lord." Jesus got in Peter's boat and launched out a little ways to give space between Himself and the crowd that He might speak to them, and that the water might act as a natural amplifier. Water does that. I took my kids to Lost Creek Dam yesterday. It was great. We were the only ones there. And the kids were clear around the bend, my older kids were, and we could talk to them quite easily because our voices would just skim off the lake and bounce right up to where they were on the bank there. Water's a wonderful amplifier. So Jesus, using water as a natural PA system, launched out a bit. And when He finished speaking to the crowd, He said, "Peter, take your boat back. Launch out into the deep and let down your nets." "Oh, Lord," Peter said. "We were fishing all last night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at Thy word, we will do so." So Peter took his boat, went out to the deep, a place where you didn't fish in Galilee. You always fished in the shallower regions. That's where the schools hung out. But he did so at the word of the Lord, let down his nets, and you know the story. The haul was so humongous that the boat almost sunk. What does that tell me? First of all, it tells me you can't outgive the Lord. If you let the Lord borrow your boat, He's going to fill it with fish. The Lord is not going to be a debtor to any man, to any woman. If you give to Him of your resources, of your energy, of your ability, of your money, whatever it might be, He's not going to owe you one. We will always be in debt to Him. He will be in debt to no one. So, "Peter, you let me use your boat? Thank you. I'll fill it with fish." It also tells me that the Lord sometimes will whisper in my ear, "Johnny, launch out to the deep. A new area. Go deeper than you've gone before, John, in faith, in understanding, in praise, in prayer, whatever it might be. Go deeper. That's where the fish are. Even if I failed previously, but Lord, I fished there before and not much happened, yet at Your word, Lord, I will go and lower my nets." Could that be a word of the Lord for you? Could the Lord be saying to some of you right now, "Launch out into the deep water. Go deeper. Go deeper." Well, Peter also had a special miracle. When he was on the sea at a different time and the storm was raging round him, you recall the story, they were fighting the storm, And all of a sudden, about 4 a.m., somebody comes walking towards them as those disciples were struggling at the oar. "It's a ghost," they cried. And Jesus said, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Be not afraid. If that's you, Lord, bid me to come." "Come on, Peter." And he climbed out of that boat, and Peter began to walk on water. Miracle. Then he took his eyes off the Lord and put them on the waves and the wind, and he began to sink. "Lord, save me," he cried. And Jesus stretched out his hand and grabbed Peter and put him back in that boat. I like that story. Because, you know, sometimes I get tired of the boat that I'm in, the disciples I'm rowing with, the situation that I feel boxed in by. "Lord, get me out of here," I say. Even if it means going out there where the waves are pounding, where the wind is howling, get me out of this boat. Just bid me to come. I'll go anywhere. Get me out of here, Lord. And sometimes I too move out, sink down, and the Lord picks me up and puts me right back in the same boat. Plop. And I'm starting to learn at this point in my life that man, God puts us in fixes to fix us. And if I try and fix the fix that God puts me in, getting out of the boat, he'll have to put me in another fix to fix the fix that he wanted to fix in the first place. It's true. So back in the boat, Peter went. Yet one last miracle before Jesus died. Jesus took Peter along with James and John into the Garden of Gethsemane. There they prayed. But Peter, James, and John fell asleep. Jesus continued on. Again, you know the story. The next thing Peter knew, he woke up and he saw these soldiers coming with torches and swords in their hands. And these soldiers said, "We seek Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said, "I am." Ego eimi. That is the I am, referring to his deity. I am that I am. And when he said, "I am," those soldiers fell down backwards. They stood back up again. Peter, I don't know what he was thinking, but somehow feeling as though the Lord needed protecting after he spoke the word and they fall down on their backs, draws out his little sword against perhaps hundreds of soldiers, and he starts swinging the sword around, protecting Jesus. Before Jesus could say to Peter, "Peter, put away your sword," before he could get that out, Peter hit one of the boys. He hit one of the servants that was there in that group, Malchus, the chief priest's servant, hit him in the ear. Boom. And his ear went flopping on the ground. "Put away your sword, Peter," Jesus said. And he stooped down then and picked up Malchus's ear and stuck that ear back on the side of Malchus's head. That miracle intrigues me. The last miracle that Jesus ever did concerned one of his disciples, one of his inner circle, using a sword to hurt somebody that Jesus had to heal. I wonder how many times we as disciples use our verses, use the scripture, which is the sword of the Spirit, we are told, and let it fly and hurt people in the process, quoting scriptures, making points, and people, their ears fall off and they're bloodied and beaten by our spirituality. This ought not to be. Put away your sword. If your sword is being unsheathed to cause hurt and damage to others, put it away. Jesus, the last miracle he ever did was because his right-hand man, if you would, one of his inner disciples, was using the sword wrongly, causing pain and hurt and consternation. Jesus healed him. Then Jesus died, rose again, showed himself to Peter and to the others, and then ascended into heaven. We then see Peter in Acts chapter 12 in a very difficult situation. Stay with me for just a moment more. This is real critical. In Acts 12, we read that Herod had taken James, one of the disciples, the brother of John, and killed him. We know that he sawed him in half longwise, lengthwise, and killed James. And when we are told in Acts 12, Herod saw that it pleased the Jews that James was killed, he put Peter in prison as well. In other words, Peter was about to die. The church in Acts 12 began to pray. Evidently, they weren't praying for James. They thought, oh, nothing can happen to us. It shows you right there the importance of continual, steady prayer. But when James was killed and when Peter was in prison, they got busy. But we see that Peter there in prison, kind of interesting. It says, as Peter slept there between the guards, an angel came to Peter saying, arise, go quickly. Peter thought it was a vision. He didn't think it was happening at all. He thought he was dreaming, but he went for it anyway. And when he was outside of the jail, he realized, hey, this is reality. That encourages me, by the way, to act on those things that I'm not necessarily sure of. Because sometimes it's not just a dream. It's reality. If I'll start moving, things will start happening. But be that as it may, Peter is free. Was he worried that night? Was he panicking? I wonder what I would have been doing. How about you if you were there knowing that your number was about to come up and you were going to be sawn in half or beheaded or whatever? Peter was sleeping. He was genuinely at peace. He was sound asleep. Why? Later on, Peter would write these words in 1 Peter 5:7. He would say, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. That big fisherman used that word casting. I like that. Just cast all your care. Cast every care. Cast any care. Whether you are being wrongly persecuted or whether you're in a pickle like Peter was here in chapter 17 of Matthew because of his presumption, whatever the reason might be, cast all of your care upon him because he cares for you. Gang, I really believe that Peter wrote that out of experience. Yeah, the Lord does care for me. My mother-in-law was sick and he healed her. I wasn't catching any fish and he loaded me down, almost sunk my boat. I got into this discussion with these tax collectors and was wrong in my answer and he got me out of that jam. I chopped off somebody's ear when I shouldn't have been and he healed it. And now that I'm in prison, I've got no fears. I'll just trust him. He's seen me through time and time and time again. So I'll just cast it upon him now. The word cast there is a word which describes the process of rolling a heavy object up a hill, like a stone or a wheel. Casting means rolling. You roll this upon the Lord. But if you roll a rock or a wheel up a hill, what tends to happen? It tends to come back again. People say, well, John, I've prayed about that problem. I feel like I'm out on a limb, that I'm in danger, that I'm troubled or perplexed, and I've rolled it upon him. Why now has it come back, that trouble, that lack of peace? Listen carefully. The scriptures declare that it's a process that happens continually. That is, you roll it on him, and then it comes rolling back. And you roll it on him, and it comes rolling back. You have peace for an hour or a day or a month, and then you're troubled and perplexed and anxious again. And you roll up, you say, well, what would be the purpose of God to want this process of rolling it on him and then having it come back and rolling upon him? What would be the reason for that? There was a guy named Milo in Athens centuries ago, strongest man in the world at that time. Why was he so strong? When he was a young man, one of his cows had a calf. He picked up that calf and put it on his shoulders and walked around his property and put the calf down. He did that every single day. At first, it was relatively easy. The calf got bigger and bigger and bigger until it became a full-blown ox. And Milo could still carry that ox on his shoulders because every day he was carrying that calf while it was growing, and slowly but surely he was growing along with that calf in strength, in stamina, in muscle mass. You know, I'm convinced that the Lord wants us to be studly spiritually. He's not interested in us being weak. And so he says, Johnny, I'm going to allow this to come rolling back on you after a day or two, because I want you to keep pushing it towards me every time you do it. As you commune with me, as you wait on me and talk to me, you are gaining strength. And more important than dealing with that problem, I am developing you for eternity. I want you strong, Johnny. And you'll thank me. So keep pushing. Keep rolling. And as you do, you'll find a peace that comes over you. A peace that passes understanding. You know what I found? Then we'll go. I have certain things that gnaw at me from time to time. They keep coming back and gnawing. Maybe you have problems or anxieties or worries financially, emotionally, maritally, your children. I don't know what it might be, but how do you deal with that? What does it mean to cast all your care upon him? Clovis Chapman was a pioneer aviator. He was one of the first men who attempted a solo flight around the world. In his journey, he was taking off from an area outside of San Francisco, Fremont. And as he got that plane up in the air, after about an hour or two in flight, he heard a sickening sound. He heard a gnawing going on behind him. He listened and he realized there's some animal back there, a rat, gnawing on something, some cable, some cord. He wasn't sure what it was. He couldn't leave the controls to go investigate the matter. The plane would crash. But he heard this gnawing and he thought, oh, he realized that when he stopped there in Fremont, that evidently a rat had climbed on board. Those were primitive days. They landed in fields at that time. And he thought, this is it. I can't go back. I'm not going to make it to my destination. My plane could be easily taken out of control, out of commission, depending upon what this rat is gnawing on. And for a while there, he just thought, wow. Then he had an idea. He took the wheel of that little plane and pulled it back towards him and took the nose up in the air. And that plane started to go up, up, 5,000 feet, 10,000 feet, 12,000 feet, until he listened and heard no more gnawing. He remembered that rodents need a high proportion of oxygen. So he took that plane where the oxygen was thin, and the rat died. That's what it means to cast your care upon him. When you feel a rat gnawing in you, an anxiety taking over you, a concern, a burden pressing in on you, you just kick back and cruise up. And in the atmosphere of praise and prayer, the rat can't survive. The enemy can't live. The rat can't survive in that high place of heaven. And he'll leave you. Praise is powerful. Prayer is potent. That's what Peter said. Hey, I've been through it, he would tell us. Cast your care upon him and sleep like a baby. He cares for you. He saw me through over and over again. Shall we stand? I'm going to ask again that no one move unless you absolutely need to. And shall we bow our heads together? And I wonder, as we stand in this place, in the house of the Lord, because he's promised to be whenever two or three gather together, he would be in the midst. Maybe like Peter, in this story, you know that you've done something or said something that has got you into a pickle. Maybe it was even a dumb thing. Maybe you feel like, man, I'm overextended, I'm in trouble, I'm hurting. Maybe somebody you care about, that you're linked with, going through difficulty. I don't know what the burden, what the worry might be, but I do know what the solution is. Cast your care upon him right now. Not leaving here saying, well, that's kind of an interesting thought. But we would be amiss, and I think dumb, not to take advantage of an opportunity to right now say, I'm going to take that plane into the atmosphere of prayer and praise. I'm going to cast that care upon him. We're going to take a couple of moments in complete quietness, but I'm going to ask you, whatever it is that's gnawing at you, that's causing difficulty within you, whatever it might be, that right now you would take that and cast it upon him in prayer with praise and thanksgiving. Give it to the Lord. And you'll experience a peace in your heart. But John, you say, what if it comes back 2 hours from now? Then you keep rolling it on him. You take the plane up yet again. And every time it comes back down your way, not resenting it, but embracing it as an opportunity to grow, to become a spiritual Milo. Gaining strength. Casting your care upon him. He'll see you through. take a moment right now, would you please? And in quietness, but verbalize the words in a whisper quietly so your mind isn't spacing, so your thoughts aren't wandering. Just articulate those words with your lips and just talk to the Lord for a moment or two, whatever it might be that's troubling you. We stand with Peter now, Father, who by experience in his own history found that he could trust you completely. So we too now affirm and acknowledge that you are trustworthy. And if you desire to take these cares as you tell us you do, if you desire to bear these burdens as you've told us you would, we gladly hand them over to you now. And we receive that peace that passes understanding.